Hello and welcome to episode number 37 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galluzzo. Joining me is Mr. Elric Kane.
Hey man, how's it going?
What's up? We are Beckaless.
It feels so good. I feel refreshed, rejuvenated.
You're Beckaless, but you've gained a Ryan.
Ryan is back from Sundance. Holy smokes. Ryan Turek, welcome.
Hello.
Yeah, man.
The frost is melting off my body still.
Oh, man. We're going to get a full report from Sundance after we go over the movies that we've seen. But first and foremost, this is exciting. I'm really happy that we are opening up our sponsorships to a lot of really good folks and companies that we already love and support. So this particular episode right now is sponsored by Severn Films.
Love them.
Love Severn. So you need to check out Severn Films' newest release, Wild Beasts, from one of Italia's most controversial directors, Franco Prosperi. I can attest that this is a controversial film. We will talk about that later. Listen to this plotline. When PCP gets into the water supply of the city zoo, When PCP gets into the water supply of the city zoo, the drug-crazed beasts, including tigers, hyenas, seeing-eye dogs, and sewer rats, go berserk and rampage through the streets of Rome. This is the greatest eco-revenge shocker in your occult history. The original poster screamed, "When nature revolts, you've never seen a film get so bloody." So Wild Beasts is now on Blu-ray and DVD for the first time, and it's packed with special features because Severn always does it right. It's available now from all retailers, and it comes with a free poster if you order directly from severn-films.com. So for more info on Wild Beasts and other amazing movies, plenty of which we've reviewed on the show, make sure you follow Severn Films on Facebook. And we're going to talk about this movie next week when both Ryan and I have had a chance to properly let it sink in.
You had me as seeing eye dogs.
Right.
So I'm totally
that was the one.
How far off are we from Kathy's Curse? Do we know?
I don't know. I hope that's their next big one.
This is the company bringing you Kathy's Curse, and that will be a special moment for
everyone. That was one of the greatest moments in Shockwave's history when you just spit that out, like, are you going to put out Kathy's Curse? Like, randomly, like, yeah, actually, we are.
Yeah. That was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely check out Severn Films.
I cannot wait for this film because I've never seen it.
You have a soft spot for animal amok movies.
I have a soft spot for nature run amok movies, big time. Yeah, Day of the Animals, Grizzly.
I watched Day of the Animals at your place for the first time,
that's
Blu-ray.
Right. Yeah.
And there was one moment where both me and your dog, Herman, jumped so high because we thought a car crashed into your apartment, and it was actually just the movie.
It was a good sound mix on that disc.
That's a good Blu-ray right there.
That was a good Blu-ray.
So we've all seen a couple of films that we want to talk about before.
And I was going to say, well, we just got done doing a little live feed on Facebook.
Yes.
So if you're listening to this Friday and you missed it, well, maybe that's something we'll bring back week after week.
Sure.
Maybe.
Sure. I hope it wasn't. Sure. You got the peek behind the curtain.
A peek behind.
The pandemonium before the show
see
starts.
See the
All righty. Well, I'm going to kick us off because I've been waiting to talk about this for a while.
Do it. Mm-hmm.
First of all, a couple episodes ago, I had mentioned that I brought a friend to the Museum of Death, which you guys immediately made me feel awkward about.
Who is this mystery friend?
This mystery friend is sitting in the room right now by chance, and her name is Joanne. Hi.
Hi.
So this is the mysterious Museum of Death girl. And the reason I bring her up is because she was a part of this first film that I saw. Now, Ryan, I know you're going to get upset, so hear me out before I talk about Texas Chainsaw 3D. Now, the reason—
Wait a minute. You're the one that needed to see this?
No. She was just part of the ride.
Got it.
What happened was several months ago, I was catching up over lunch with Kyle Kuchka, who used to work at Jump Cut Cafe for Elric. And his wife is not a horror fan, but— At that point, they were marathoning all the Texas Chainsaw movies. He's like, oh, I'm finally showing her all the movies, yada, yada. And I can't remember which one they were up to. They were like halfway there. And I was like, look, when you get to 3D, it's not good, but I do have it in 3D. And both of you should come over and we'll watch it that way because at least it'll be kind of fun, you know? The other thing he alerted me to is that his wife talks through movies nonstop. He's like, I know it's going to annoy most people. I was like, you know what? Doesn't matter for Texas Chainsaw 3. She's more than welcome to add commentary to this movie. Yeah. So she came over and Joanne joined us as well. And this movie is far worse than I possibly remembered. I sort of like mildly enjoyed it in theaters, but the logic gaps right off the bat. So they redo the end of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre and then kind of vaguely pick up 20 some odd years later, whatever.
40 years later.
The funny thing is,
something like that.
I want to say within 5 minutes of meeting all the horrible, unlikable characters that we met, Joe totally called this movie. Like, she's like, all right, so she's cheating with that guy, right? and mild spoiler, and she's like, so is Leatherface going to try to kill the main girl and then realize that she has the scar and then totally stop and be like, oh, we're family.
Oh,
and I was like, I know it sounds ridiculous that you just said it out loud, but wow, are you sure you've never seen this movie before? She's never seen it.
It's her favorite movie.
She's totally
lying to her face right now.
Every moment in this movie. But yeah, this is one of those movie by committee kind of, like, I noticed every decision. Like,
I was on set.
You were?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. They flew me out to set. And, you know, I think, I'm forgetting the director's name. He didn't come from a horror background. I think before that he had done some sort of crime drama. Carl Mazzacone, who was part of the Twisted Pictures team, at the time, you know, he was like the key producer on it. And, you know, there was a lot of love I felt on set and reverence for the original film because they had all some of the original cast members out, you know, and then you had Bill Moseley going, well, I'm playing someone else this time.
Yeah,
you know?
Chop Top. Not Chop Top. He's Drayton Sawyer.
Yeah, he's Drayton Sawyer. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it was the day that they were going to burn the house down, or a day before they were going to burn the house down, and a Black Maria truck was in the driveway. And I was like, is that the Black Maria out there? And they're like, yeah, we're going to tie it all in and blah, blah, blah. There was a little bit of love there, but it's obviously a little bit misguided.
Yeah,
whole storytelling.
But but then the rest of it, the way that it all plays out, because then they like introduce these plot threads that they just completely forget about, you know, and they're just like so many decisions, like the girl shooting the gun and saying, welcome to Texas. And I'm like, why would you be saying welcome to Texas when you're from out of town? Like why are you the badass that's from Texas all
You know it's not by committee? Alexandra Daddario is so hot in this movie that I give the movie an official pass.
Wow.
Oh,
because that is the level of hotness that she brings to that role.
There's good set pieces that are just ways, like him running into the carnival should have been an epic moment.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just not at all fulfilling.
And doesn't he take out like some horror icons or people dressed like horror
icons?
He
goes after like, Jigsaw for a moment because it's the in-house joke and all that. But
the do your thing cuz line is like, I bet in a room that could actually be kind of fun. Ridiculous like bad cult
even
movie.
With four people in the room it was fun.
Yeah.
And because I've been
it's the only moment I remember.
Literally been texting Kyle for 6 months, do your thing cuz, like that's been the thing, and his wife couldn't believe that was an actual line.
Yeah, there's nothing in that movie that other than that is memorable. I can't remember.
I wish the series would get course corrected in a way that makes it pleasurable.
Right,
you know? I don't even think you can. Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I mean, if you go into my dining room, I've got two, like, the original foreign posters in there. I've got, like, my dining room is dedicated to Texas Chainsaw. And it's like, it has such a strong place in my heart. And I love Texas Chainsaw, too. And I kind of love Texas Chainsaw. I love Leatherface.
I love 3.
You know, 3 has got that David Scow voice to it.
Yes.
And it's a real shame that they can't get the subsequent entries right.
And you can't be nostalgic about it. I think you'd have to reinvent it for a modern audience, because what's scary about the first one is like it's modern day people who are hippies, you know, wandering into this thing that's savage and ugly and scary. Yeah. So if you look at it through that lens and make it set in the 70s it just doesn't work.
I mean,
anymore.
Like, look, I like Marcus and Disciple's remake. I mean, like, it's a beautiful looking movie.
Yeah, it's well made.
And it tries to adhere to the time. Maybe you just got to break the boundaries of time and, like you said, do something contemporary. What is a contemporary Chainsaw Massacre?
And also glossiness doesn't suit that franchise.
No.
Like the whole point, the first one is just so gritty and it works for it. I think the glossier you go, the more Michael Bay or whatever it looks, the worse that kind of gets.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, look, we had fun watching it and the 3D gags worked great. Everyone jumped when chainsaws were coming at us.
Rob told me that he's showing this. And then it got on my nerves.
You had board game night and you're like, how dare you miss board game night for this?
Well, also, like, you told me the day before, and then that morning I was like getting ready for my day. And then I was like, why is Rob wasting his time? And then I made sure to tell him. I was like, Rob, surely you have better things to do. And he was like, no, I got to show some friends.
I made a promise, and I take this thing seriously, and everybody had to. I made popcorn, and there, you know. It's a wonderful night.
It's 3D.
She's like, yeah, he made the hot dogs.
Yeah, went all out.
I did a good job. I tried. Well, you know, and I really hope that new one comes out, because I hear the rumors I've heard is that it's pretty darn good, and it's the guys that did Inside, and it's just such a shame that it's been on the shelf as long as it has.
Yeah.
You know, also don't be misled. I saw in Dread Central that some other unrelated movie got retitled Leatherface and has a guy that looks like him on the front of the chainsaw.
Yeah.
Oh, and even the director didn't know that they were doing that. So everyone's like, by the way, that is not the prequel Leatherface. That is some unrelated movie that some distributor put that on the cover of. So
hatchet job movie.
Don't be fooled by that. Yeah. You know. So what about you, Ryan?
This weekend, well, after decompressing from Sundance, I had purchased Highway to Hell from 1991.
Love that movie.
Still never seen that one. I want to see that.
You should check it out. I'll let you borrow my Blu-ray. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Give you a little bit of context to the nostalgia I have tied into this movie, which in no way sways my thoughts on the current of the film today. But the first time I was introduced to it was at a Fangoria Weekend of Horror show in 90. And when you walked up to buy your ticket, there was this giant standee of the Hell Cop.
Yeah,
who is this badass dude. And he has like these symbols and passages carved into his skin. And I was like, I need to know who the Hell Cop is. I want to know what this movie is. But it made it look real hardcore. I was like, oh, Highway to Hell, man. What? It's going to be debaucherous and it's going to get bloody. What the film really is a fantastical tale about a man who goes into hell to find his girlfriend. And that man
love
is played
story.
By Chad. It's a love story. It's played by Chad Lowe, and Christy Swanson's his girlfriend. And then you've got Patrick Bergen playing the devil. And then you've got an array of cameos from Ben Stiller to Jerry Stiller to
Gilbert Gottfried is Hitler
and Lita Ford. Lita Ford was a big draw for me when I was a kid. But the movie, you know, as it stands today, you know, it was funny. I revisited it in probably 2000. It was like on DVD or Laserdisc, and I was like, nope, doesn't hold up. I mean, like, you know, it just doesn't, like, I think I was at an age where I was a little bit more critical. And then over the weekend, I tossed it on, and you have to admire its ambition and its scope and the love story they tried to inject into it. And it's just a ride. It's one of those journey movies where it's like, let's just take a fish out of water and drop him into something he's not accustomed to. And in this case, you know, you got Chad Lowe running around hell. So hell is filled with dead people, and it's got restaurants and cafes and, you know, hotels and casinos, and along the way they just inject all of these kind of like little nuances. You know, the Hell Cop doesn't have handcuffs. He's literally got hands that can cuff you.
Steve Johnson work, by the way.
Steve Johnson work. Yeah. CJ Graham, who played Jason Voorhees. Jason Lives plays the Hell Cop, and he's great. But, you know, the spectacle alone and the effects alone are just really appealing. They pull off some really cool stunts. They pull off some cool effects. They're dated, obviously, but it's just a fun ride. You know?
Yeah, I think Elric always talks about the fantastic element of horror in the 80s. This was 91, and I feel like this was the last gasp of it. But I mean, what I remember revisiting it a few months ago is the ambition behind it. Like, it's such a crazy, wild kind of movie that you wouldn't expect. Like, you know, they just don't make them like they used to.
And I should say that Brian Helgeland wrote that.
It.
And,
yeah.
You know, he's the one behind L.A. Confidential and 42. And
Conspiracy Theory.
Yeah.
Same year directed by the guy that did Drop Dead Fred.
And how do you pronounce that dude's name?
I don't know.
Ate Jung. But it's a fun movie. If you can, you know, don't be deceived by its cover. It's a terrible cover. And I'm not talking about the Blu-ray release, but the poster that was going around. It's like Patrick Bergen and devil makeup, and then just like a cut and paste of Chad Lowe and Christy Swanson. But,
yeah. The Blu-ray cover's cool.
Yeah, the Blu-ray. And it's interchangeable. You can change it. You can switch it back to like some foreign art. So, yeah,
right.
I definitely recommend it.
I'm in. Even though it doesn't sound very horror-y, it sounds.
It's not very horror-y. Yeah. It's fun. It's got horror elements. Yeah.
I've never seen a bad Blumhouse movie. So starting with that,
where are you going with this?
No. I saw Split, top couple all-time Blumhouse movies.
Yes,
I'd say it's M. Night's best movie, maybe, but definitely his best outside to me. Sixth Sense, I know Unbreakable fans obviously called that one really high.
First two are pretty high on my list.
It's,
and
it's,
this is,
you know,
up there at least in terms of craft, execution and craft.
Craft and idea. And I'll tell you, and this, I'll do the spoiler free because a lot of you haven't caught up with it yet. But what's nice about this movie, and I think what maybe has hurt his last few movies, is a lot of his films depend on a last second twist that then redefines what you just watched. And even though you've heard by now, everyone talks about something that happens at the end of this movie. Okay, forget that though. In terms, in general, with this movie, what's happening is something that's on the table, you know, from the midpoint on, and it's a build towards something scary or something that's happening. And that is really rewarding. And the way he puts that tension and suspense to you is so much stronger to me than when he just pulls the rug in the last second. That is what I think defined this movie. Also, great performances.
McAvoy's.
But McAvoy, there's a scene that's in the spoiler. I tweet it straight after. There's scenes where he's dancing in it, where in that moment, I get so lost in the moment of watching it that I'm like, this is special. Like, this guy is giving it all to you on screen, and he loses himself a little bit, and that's rare. And I know Joaquin at one point, you know, obviously because he's worked with him right before.
Hedwig is that character, right?
Had Joaquin, even though I'm a big Joaquin fan, Joaquin's too real. And, you know, you watch The Master and people get unnerved when they watch that. They go, it's almost too much of a, you almost are worried about the man behind the role. I feel like McAvoy is like, because he's so nice and because he's got like this persona, when he goes there and shows you all these other sides, it is just so much fun. And and it really is just one of the most fun movies I've seen in a long time. But it makes me really excited about M. Night as a director again.
Yeah.
And I think it probably will energize. I mean, his last two films have both been good, but this one's particularly strong. I this is the kind of movie you make it, and you can imagine Marvel knocking right after. And then there is a, you know, there is a big twist that changes the perspective, but I don't think in a way that ruins or has to alter your film. It's just a different way of seeing
it. I didn't look
film.
At it as a twist in the same way that like his previous movies had a twist. No. I looked at it more of like reward.
It's a compliment. It's a reward.
It's a reward. It's a little reward. But by the way, here's another way you can look at this.
And I've
like,
had,
oh, that's cool.
And I know we're beating around the bush because we don't want to ruin it, but I've had friends who have then seen it the second time and said it's a totally different experience because of that information. So so it is a different way to view it. But
I like I said, I knew it going in, which really bummed me out. Yeah. So I saw that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it does change the context, but I love it. And I love what people are – the things that I see people quoting, like one thing I keep seeing in common threads is et cetera. Like, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's pretty cute.
And there's something – I don't know. There's something clean about it, too. That sounds weird. It's not like pervy. And there's something like – you could show this to anyone and it works as a thrill. You wouldn't have to hide it because of some sort of weird depravity. I don't know. I think it's just a really good film. And maybe a couple months from now we can talk about it a bit more.
Yeah.
Or honestly, do our spoiler episode.
Yeah, exactly. But also The Girl from the Witch, I'm telling you, she's
terrific.
Not just as an actress, but as an expressionist actress, which I think is something we don't get much of anymore. I think most of the actresses now, you know, CW kind of world, it's all verbally telling you about their character. She does so much in both The Witch and this movie.
She's great.
With her face and just being. And I think it's great.
Awesome. I got another title, another 3D title, actually. This one I picked up from Twilight Time, and I'd never seen it. I never even heard of it, but it's The Mad Magician from 1954, a Vincent Price movie, directed by John Brom, who also did The Lodger and several episodes of Twilight Zone, the original Twilight Zone. And, you know, it's Vincent Price. I've seen the classics, but he's one of those, much like the Hammer subgenre, he's one of, like, I've never seen every Vincent Price movie. There's just too many. But ever since those box sets came out, I'm slowly going through some of the gems that I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
But this is an obscure one that Twilight Time put out that was at the tail end of the 3D kind of boom of that, you know, which started with, ironically enough, with House of Wax, and then now it kind of ends with The Mad Magician.
Right.
This movie is so much fun and easily like in my top five Vincent Price movies because he is a magician, or at least it opens with him doing a show, his own solo show, because all these years he's been kind of an assistant and helping build like contraptions for other magicians, and now he finally wants his shot at it. And of course, just as he's about to, his old boss and the magician he used to work for show up and like, we own all your stuff. Like, you can't do your own. Those gags belong to us and this and that. So of course, you know, and then you realize that this boss also stole his wife. So that's his ex-wife.
Of course.
So everything's bubbling up and it's kind of like, and also his big trick, which nobody else can do. And it's in the opening, is he can put on makeup and look like the other magician. So it's got that little weird, like, Darkman quality where he can look like everybody else.
That's cool.
And so there's a few moments throughout the movie where he disguises himself as other people. But here's what's great about it. In every scene, it is Vincent Price in makeup. Mm. Like, you could tell that it's him, and he's so freaking good. Like, so you get three or four different Vincent Price roles in this one movie.
That's cool.
And then the irony is he goes to get an alibi by staying at this house, and the house he stays at or rents the room out of, the couple that lives there, the girl of the couple, the woman, is a writer of murder mysteries.
Naturally.
So of course, like, as soon as she gets involved, all of a sudden it's just a lot of fun and kind of funny in that way. Like, right, what are the odds that this mad magician goes and stays at this house where all of a sudden he's on the trail of a murder mystery novelist who wants to get involved in the case?
Awfully convenient.
So it's a lot of fun. Yeah. You know, the 3D gags are pretty good. It's not as strong as, say, House of Wax in terms of, you know, milking that gimmick, but there's some cool stuff in it, and I just had so much fun. And it's 72 minutes long.
As most of those movies. Yeah.
Perfect wow. time.
Well, we're going to take a little dip from that quality and talk a little bit about a guilty pleasure franchise of mine that is called Resident Evil. And yes, I know I lost most of you, perhaps 95% of the listening audience. However, the Resident Evil series, for some strange reason, I just have an appeal to it. I've lived with it, you know. I saw a test screen. I was one of the first test screenings of it way back in the day.
Nice.
In which I believe I flipped the screen off in the middle of the test screening when Paul Anderson ripped off the newspaper headline that said "The Dead Walk."
Oh yeah,
From Romero. But then it like grew on me for some reason. And then, you know, I was at a point in my life where I was kind of low and I needed some Resident Evil and I saw Apocalypse. And then I moved back to LA and it was feeling good. And I saw Extinction and Extinction was great. And then it just went on and on. So,
don't you love this backstory?
So 1 week ago, I snuck away and I went to go see Resident Evil, the final chapter.
Oh.
And what a closer it is, fellas.
Is it final? Is this it, finally?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
It depends how much it made. Right?
No. Which it wasn't much, apparently. Yeah. But no, listen, guys. If you are a sucker for Resident Evil films like I am, then I think you'll be heartily satisfied by this conclusion, which is pretty much wall-to-wall action. Wall-to-wall action and creatures. Whether you can see the creatures or not remains to be seen because the action is so
fast,
fast and cut in such a way that it's incomprehensible.
You're really selling it, man.
No, I know, totally.
I found that in the
news. Listen, I'm giving you the pros and the cons, man.
Okay. How's Kate Beckinsale look in these movies? Because she always looks great in these movies. I feel like that's why these movies exist. They're
wrong,
like fashion.
Yeah, wrong franchise.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Sorry.
Wrong franchise.
Interchangeable.
I'm thinking of Mila. Yeah, you're right.
No, but I mean, in terms of like taking things back around to the first film and closing up the chapter for Alice and all this other kind of stuff, it was just like, okay, I'm with it. That's
how many
fine.
Games did they make? Did they make as many games?
Okay, so
but the game.
I'm at a segue. I was going to segue into this because
here comes.
I bought Resident Evil 7 last week and I spent the weekend playing a good 4 hours of it. Just a really quick wrap up, final chapter. If you're a sucker for it, you'll enjoy it. It's got tons of flaws, but whatever. Guilty pleasure. Moving on to Resident Evil 7, the video game. Holy fucking shit, guys. This game is scary as shit. I haven't played since Resident Evil 4. Resident Evil 4, I was going through a divorce, so I got holed up in an apartment and just played Resident Evil 4 for like 72 hours, and I felt better about myself.
This series follows your dark period.
Oh, yes. And I might as well just get personal. Why not?
Yeah, let's do it.
So Resident Evil 7, I haven't played for two chapters. Jump into this one, and it's a very Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of atmospheric vibe to it, where you play this guy who needs to go find his wife who has been missing for 3 years. You get an email out of the blue and it's like, meet me at this house. And you're like, okay, I'm going to go meet you at the house. So you go to the house. She's not there. You're wandering around the house. All of a sudden she comes out and she's fucking possessed and she wants to chop you up. Now that's about as far as I got because truth be told, I am a sucker and I jump like a sissy. When it comes to horror video games, I don't jump at films. I don't jump at anything else. My girlfriend got to watch firsthand what I get like, and I become a mess of a man. So there was a point where I got knocked out from behind, and There was a character that made me jump, and I literally flew out of my couch. And she was like, "What is wrong with you? No more Resident Evil before bedtime." And I was like, "I can't deal with this right now. I need to focus." I had the lights down. But listen, kudos to Capcom and the gamers, the game programmers behind this one. I'm not even done yet. I don't know if I'll be able to finish it because I just might be just a complete wreck. But if you guys are gamers, then by all means, pick it up because it is fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't quite top that.
But you can try.
But this is when Ryan mentioned a couple months ago, and I realized at the time, because I'd seen the bad remake, I felt like I'd seen the original, but I had never seen House on Sorority Row.
Oh.
And it is streaming on Amazon, I believe. And it was very different than Sorority Row, which I did watch it when it came out in theaters and, you know, didn't particularly like, but it was very slick, one of those kind of remakes. But the story's completely different, like not even connected at all, because in Sorority Row, it's like they kill one of their own and then they cover it up and then they, you know, slowly get picked off like a slasher film in the remake. In the original, it's about like a house mistress, an older woman, but there's a weird backstory about weird childbirth and experiments and doctors and has all sorts of crazy shit. I felt like watching the first almost two-thirds, I was like, oh no, this is cool, but it's nothing special. Like, it's one of those movies you're like, yeah, it's like a lot of other slashes from that period. The last third of this movie is so fucking good.
Yeah.
And it's so different than the rest of it. It's not like it's a mild shift. It's like the first two-thirds are very much a jump out and kill you. There's no killer perspective shots, which is interesting. It's always just like it jumps out and gets you. You don't know who the killer is. They've pulled a ridiculous practical joke, which makes no sense at all. It's so stupid. Accidentally shooting their fucking house mistress, this older woman, and then burying her in a pool. And you're like, oh.
They leave her in a pool. And then they spend their time just like throwing a party and being concerned about what's out of the pool.
Yeah, and actually,
sure,
that's the
out.
Most interesting thing about this is your average film from that period will have, we do a crime or something goes wrong, we cover it up, and then 3 years later or 20 years later is when the
current
story. This is happening while they are covering up the crime they just committed like that day.
Right.
And so all the people who start getting picked up like right in the moment. So I actually thought that was pretty cool. But like towards this last act, it starts, you actually have a part where like a character's drugged and she starts like tripping balls and she starts seeing some really interesting filmmaking and that sequence and actually really creepy clown imagery. That whole last third is like a really interesting movie, and I would highly recommend the film for that sequence alone. But I did think about this film. I think you could make a really interesting remake of that title, making it a lot more realistic as a film, because I feel like as the unrealistic and silly way that the setup has kind of under.
Did you see Sorority Row?
Yeah, but it's like a remake of something. It's not a remake of that movie.
Right.
It's a very different story. I'm talking about like a realistic.
You want a realistic. You want a grounded. You want
a grounded sorority. Something goes wrong, and then somebody starts getting you. That's what I want.
Right.
Can we have a green light?
No.
Can I get a kumbaya?
No. Okay, sorry. Sorority Row still in my mouth.
But watch it. It's really fun.
Bad taste.
Film. And again, I'm on a roll this year, seeing some of these slashers I hadn't seen before. It's really nice. They're not all the best transfers. This one's okay.
I
think it's on Amazon. I'd have to look it
up. I'm going to look it up if it's that or Shudder.
Yeah, it wasn't HD. I could tell that. You know. But it wasn't VHS.
Speaking of Amazon, or Shudder more appropriately, so I carved a night out, and it was me, Sadako, and Kayako.
Yes.
I was so excited about this. I was waiting for it to premiere.
I love it.
And also, you know, congratulations to Shudder. This is a big win because I saw a lot of people across the board, people that we interact with online, that this was what they were waiting for, and I hope it did really well for them. This movie is a fucking blast from start to finish. It's just – it's like – I can't explain it, but it's and somebody asked me, do I need to see any of the other ones? Not really. No. They pretty much fill you in.
I mean, you should get like the first chapter of each one.
Yeah, I'd say the first of each is kind of not essential, but recommended. It'll enhance your enjoyment of it. But it's like it took all the elements and the mythologies of both franchises, combined them in a way that was interesting. Although I thought it was a little heavier on Ringu than it was The Grudge or Ju-on. But it was just so much fun. And my roommate and I sat up late and watched it one night. And again, it's like the way that they approached it, the death sequences were really cool. The characters, like when
it's
they
got
brought
a tongue-in-cheek quality to
very
it.
Very tongue-in-cheek quality. And the way that they, you know, kind of brought in for lack of a better term, like an exorcist type dude with his like his blind yeah. little sidekick. I mean, it's like that's what I love, is fun, quirky characters that you can only get away with in a Japanese movie like this. So and and again, you get your fill of both monsters. There's one sequence, I don't want to give anything away, obviously, but there's an early sequence in the Juon house with Kayako involving a group of kids, like literally young kids, like 10 or 12 years old, where basically one of them gets bullied into going to the house. And if you go into the house, you know, her and the little kid will come after you. So it's a great sequence where basically the kid stands up to the bully and they all end up in the house. And it's just and it's great. It's just like, oh man, that was really cool and scary and fun how they twisted it. And the way they got them together was pretty cool. I mentioned to Ryan that I wish they, and it's not really a spoiler, I guess they fought more.
Yeah.
but it still was cool. And then the ending kind of is like, oh, all right, cool.
I feel like just to take a little knock at the haters out there that don't like this.
Oh, do people not like this? What do they want?
I know.
You know what you're
getting
into. Let's not
forget some of the greatest mashups, you know, left, save the best for the end.
Uh-huh.
Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Yep.
The Wolfman jumps off a brick and lands on Frankenstein's monster, and then water comes and washes them away. That's all you get.
That's like 30 seconds.
That's 30 seconds.
Of a 90-minute movie.
and Freddy versus Jason, of course. Yeah. But no, I'm right there with you. I think it's a blast. I mean, like, you know, I feel like there was a little bit of criticism where people were like, well, it didn't hold up. They didn't pay respect to the other, you know, respective franchises. And I'm like, let's not forget that the respective franchises kind of got run into the ground in Japan.
Yeah, and like there's Ring has like multiple timelines.
Multiple timelines and series, you know, entries, and The Grudge, Juon has multiple entries, and it's like a remake. And it's like, no. It was high time for a little mashup and have a little fun with it.
Yeah,
you know?
And by fun, I'll give you an example. I was telling Ryan when we got out of a movie recently, like, oh, I love oh shit moments. And especially if it's played somewhat for humor, but kind of fun. Like, so early in the movie when somebody buys a VCR with the tape in it. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
And then when they call back the store that they bought it at, they're like, no, we sold that. And the girl that works at the store is like, oh yeah, I remember that. I watched that tape 2 days ago, you know?
Oh, yeah,
so it's like, oh, like literally. So this is where, cause in that version, it's 2 days, not seven. So literally it's like, oh yeah. So it's like any second now something terrible is going to happen to her.
Nice.
Like the way that they set up that punchline is like, oh, this is great. So I think it's a lot of fun. And also it's great if you've never seen the franchises, cause I feel like it's a good amalgamation of J-horror, what is the most popular J-horror stuff. So
I like the idea that Shudder is going to get some premieres like that, and maybe, you know, because that's the kind of service you really do want to see keep growing, and maybe start producing movies.
Oh,
and,
sure.
Like Netflix. If there was a Netflix of horror, that would be freaking cool.
Yeah. So Shudder. Thumbs up.
And is it true? I mean, I subscribe to Shudder through Amazon, my Amazon Prime account, but I heard that there is stuff that you can only access if you just have the Shudder app.
That might be true, because I know it took me a while to find that show that they was an exclusive.
Right.
It didn't show up on Amazon right away.
It's there. Yeah.
Now it is.
Yeah.
But when they announced it, it wasn't there right away. So
what I wonder if there's someone we can ask about. Can you personalize your Amazon? Because if you go on the internet version or the app version, there's way more
options than
comes up on your Amazon stream. So I wonder if there's a way to like do it on your app and then it would show up on your Amazon.
Yeah.
What you would arranged.
Yeah, I'm afraid I might have to like get two separate subscriptions.
I mean, it's still pretty early in their run, though, so they might still be kind of at that stage where they haven't done that. But
sure.
Well, to compliment. Yes.
Anything else before you go into Sundance?
Oh no, I was just gonna add one more movie.
Oh yeah,
I got one more.
Yeah, go. Sorry.
I was gonna add The Grudge. I saw The Grudge.
I gave it a revisit to the American
Grudge
Which
from 2004
of those two, because I haven't seen the original for a long time.
The original. It was funny because I feel like Takeshi Shimizu, who directed The Grudge in 2004. Based on a script by Steven Susko and stars Sarah Michelle Gellar, you know, it doesn't hold up like I thought it would, like The Ring does.
Yeah,
you know, The Ring holds up really well. I realized that
Rob does not agree.
Juon and The Grudge movies, I think, are one-timers. You know, because they're an experience, they're a narrative experience, because they play with story structure in such an odd way that once the surprises are there, you know, you don't have any. emotional investment in any of the characters. Now, they tried to do a good emotional anchor in Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, but because we're already, it's adhering to the original in a way that it starts to kind of go tangentially off into other characters and stuff like that. So you kind of lose sight of Sarah Michelle Gellar's character. But I mean, like, I feel like some of the scares still work. I saw it with some other folks who hadn't seen it in, you know, 10 years either. And at the end, we were just kind of like, oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, it was completely fine. At the time, I really liked it. I was like a staunch supporter of the Grudge remake. But it's weird. It's weird how those, like that J-horror period, you know, whether it holds up or not, how it has aged over time. Now, Gore Verbinski in The Ring, I mean, like, I still find that film beautiful looking and really, really well written as well. I mean, like, and then also the performance of Naomi Watts is fantastic, you know.
Remember the remake of Dark Water? I wanted it to go somewhere. It just never quite. It had all the dread and the buildup, and it just never delivered.
Yeah, that's one I've never seen, and I hear the original's Jennifer pretty Conley great.
On. Yeah, the original's dark, better.
I disagree, unfortunately. Like, for some reason, I like none of the American versions of these work for me, and I just think it's just lost in translation. Like, I love the Japanese versions, and I've been trying to revisit the American ones lately. I'd like to rewatch The Grudge, though, because the Blu-ray has the director's cut, which is a more slightly violent R cut of it, and I've never seen the second one, which I think Amber, I saw the second. Amber Tamblyn, who's the lead of that one?
I think so, I mean, like, in defense of The Ring, you know, again, it all comes down to the performance and the writing. There's that great scene, just as an example, where Naomi Watts, you know, starts to investigate. You know, she starts to do her investigation, and she goes to the house where they found the girl, and then she sees all the girl's, like, friends hanging out on the balcony, and she goes outside. And, you know, at first they're kind of like blocking her, you know, from any info. And then she's like, you got a cigarette? And once these teenagers see this older woman just kind of wanting to hang out, they start to open up a little bit more. And I was like, that's a nice little nuance, you know, nice little character flavor to throw in there to keep the plot going. And, you know, the horse death still freaks the shit out of me. And, you know, and I think it just works. It doesn't have has the cultural relevancy that it did in Japan, but in the U.S., translated to U.S., it's just a good ghost story.
Yeah. I do want to revisit the originals of those. It is woman. It is Woman and Horror Month, and I am a very big fan of diversity in movie making and diversity in horror. And I'm not a big fan of diversity. So as You Will Like Me, I am a big fan of diversity in those movies because I want to see new stories. For the rest of my life, I want to stay in love with movies, and I truly believe if the status quo was maintained, that wouldn't happen. I truly believe that. There's certain movies I've seen in my life where I felt like, oh my God, I don't know. Like, I feel like I could never have made that, and there's a lot of guys, no guy who could. And Jane Campion's one of those voices where I remember in the cut going, what the fuck? Like, the view on sexuality was like nothing I'd ever seen before. And I felt this way this weekend, last night when I watched, we got some screeners to watch of a movie that you guys will be seeing in about a month called Raw, which everyone has, a lot of people have already seen it on festival circuits, by Julia Docarnau, we'll try to pronounce it. Yeah. And I don't say this like this diversity thing as this because there's, you know, now, of course, if you say anything negative online, you're fucking going to be crucified anyway. So this isn't a PC statement. It's about wanting good original storytelling and films that feel fresh. And this is probably one of the freshest films I've seen. And I didn't, regardless of horror or not, just one of those films that after is like, oh yeah, I just saw a vision that somebody made their movie, and I fucking really had fun. And I have seen no trailers to this, so I'm going to try to keep you as spoiler-free. I tried to avoid it. I'd seen posters and everything. But it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And you know, one thing I would say going into it is, like, start downplaying the hype of it being the scariest or most fucked up horror film you've ever seen. Forget that. Just expect to see a great fucking movie, an entertaining movie. I kind of felt like a little bit like I felt when I first saw Irreversible and knew nothing about Gaspar Noé. Suddenly it was like, oh, I know this guy. Work now. Like, I want to watch more films by this. And a little bit like Refn and Drive, where it's like, oh, fuck, this person has something to say. It's funny, it's strange, it's got some scary parts, and it's also got some things that literally made me kind of like, ugh. You know what I mean? But it is fucking stylish, and this woman knows how to tell a great story. And the performance by Garance Marillier, I'm totally butchering, I'm sure, is just absolutely superb. It's one of the great, it will go down as one of my favorite coming of age movies. Forget if it was horror or not. It's just a great take. And so what I did today, which is something that I can give you because everyone's going to tell you Raw is great for the most part, is today I looked up where'd she come from. And I was curious, where'd this director come from? And I found that she hadn't done a feature. She went to a French film school and made two shorts. And one short was from 2011 and it played at Cannes. And if you have Amazon Prime, you can do a free thing for, I don't know, 7 days to access to all their short films, which is apparently thousands and thousands. Otherwise, it'll be $2 extra a month. So I pushed click. She made a 21-minute film with the exact same actress. So this girl who in this movie looks young, in this film, it's called Junior. It's a short film, 21-minute film, and it has every single beat of the feature. And even though, I mean, and in a good way, it's like basically a simple coming of age 20 minute drama comedy almost, but every one of the horror things that happen is experimented in this film at some point. And the same actress, so you're seeing her at like probably 13, and then she hires the same girl to play the character in Raw, and it's great to see them together. I'd probably watch the short after I see Raw, just because, you know, in case anything gets away. There's a couple horror moments in it which are super strange in this, like, you know, her body's peeling. It's much, maybe a little more body, straight body horror, but really recommend it. And it's really cool to see someone had a chance and to see the growth. It took 4 or 5 years, you know, for that voice to mature to that feature film. And there's no doubt, I'd say this is as exciting a debut as The Witch is to that director.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's that same, similar kind of thing. Mm. Like, you made something bold, and now whatever you make next, I'm interested.
Yeah.
But who knows what you'll do with it. Yeah. Right. So anyway, look for that. That's one way you can see the short film. I didn't know they were going to have similarities, so I thought that was really cool. It's just so cool to see that films, every time you get to a point where the world sucks and you turn on the news and you go, fuck, man, like, we're powerless. You watch a movie and sometimes they'll make you go, oh shit, no, we're not. We have voices. It just might take a while. And this movie's going to last a lot longer in the world than some of the bullshit sound bites coming off the TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Right on, man. I can't wait to see that one. All right, Ryan, hit us with it.
All right.
Sundance.
So this is a good segue because Raw did play at Sundance. And I didn't see it there. I saw it last year, but it got a great reception at Sundance. But it was a weird year at Sundance this year because the midnight slate wasn't pure horror. It wasn't all horror, you know. You had to kind of look at other programs this year. You had to look at a little bit on the midnight slate, but also I think it was Sundance Next. They just popped up everywhere. In fact, there was still another film that I completely missed, and somebody was like, oh, this was a genre film. And I was like, fuck, I didn't know that. But I'll talk about five films really quick too. The first one, I'll rattle them off and I'll go back. I saw the documentary 7852, which is a documentary about the shower sequence in Psycho.
Very curious.
David Lowery's A Ghost Story. Nacho Vigalondo's Colossal, Damien Power's Killing Ground, and the anthology horror film XX. Now, 7852 got picked up by, I believe, IFC.
Oh, wow.
It is a lot better than you would think when it's all about the one sequence in Psycho.
Sure.
It's an hour and a half long, but the filmmaker, Alexandre Philippe, does a fantastic job at cementing it right from the get-go, and this scene matters, and this is why. Culturally speaking, this is what it did for film. This is what, in the world climate they were living in, this is why it was a stunner. And then it kind of backtracked and went into where it came from in the story, because they did the comparison of, in the book, it was just this, but, you know, Hitchcock embellished on it. And then they kind of got into the technical stuff, and then, you know, stories with the body double, Janet Leigh's body double and stuff like that. So it's all in black and white. I had a few kind of hangups with the execution because they start to do like a little reenactment at the beginning that never gets followed through with.
Did they go through? I know YouTube has a crazy channel of people recreating that scene, like thousands of people.
They touch on it. They do from The Simpsons to Claymation to whatever. They do touch on that. But you know, all the usual suspects pop up. Mick Garris, Guillermo del Toro, you know, list goes on and on and on. So 7852 was really impressive because I was just like, how can you really milk, you know, yeah, this kind
that,
of
that was my
stuff?
Concern is can they sustain a whole feature on that one
scene? Think you, like
scene?
I said, I think you will, I think you'll really enjoy it. And it's amazing because you're following the language of the documentary. You're kind of, you know, you kind of adapt to the language of the documentary, which is black and white, shot in a certain way. And then all of a sudden they'll cut to a scene from the remake. And it's
oh, almost, Van Sant's, yeah.
Oh, from Gus Van Sant's remake. And you're like, ooh.
With the clouds,
like,
the weird shots of clouds.
Oh, well,
and stuff,
they,
and you're like, what?
One of the producers comes on and she's talking from one of the producers of the remake. She's like, yeah, we tried to recreate the shower scene. And we were trying to figure, we were in the edit room and we were doing our best to cut it up. But, you know, we did what we could. But we blew it, you know,
yeah.
And it's like, oh man. The other one was, David Lowery's A Ghost Story, which is not a horror film, possibly my favorite, horror film, my favorite film of Sundance. It's got genre, it's on the genre bubble and there are a lot of good jump scares in it. But what this really is a almost dialogue free love story. And it's got Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara.
Both
and,
from David Lowery's Ain't Them Body Saints that starred in that film, too.
And instantaneously you're like thrown into their, you know, their relationship and they've got some, you know, frayed edges about them. And then this is not a spoiler at all. I mean, you'll find it in the plot synopsis, but Casey Affleck dies. And when he returns, he's wearing a white sheet over his head and two eye holes cut through the cloth. And you can never see his eyes. And he never comes out after that.
Wow.
And so the entire film is him being bound to the house that he was living in with Rooney Mara and watching what she does. And time is much different when you're a ghost. So time passes in a way that it doesn't pass here. So he's seeing other lifetimes and he's seeing the world around him change and he's seeing other ghosts. But it was a beautiful film, really striking film. And it kind of ties in with the other film I'm going to talk about. If these films didn't have those genre elements, I'd just be taken out of the movie. They're not for me, you know.
Right.
A simple love story is, you know, whatever. That ties into Colossal as well, Nacho Vigalondo's movie, which is Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis. And it's basically about a kind of a hot mess of a woman who needs to get her life together and she gets dumped and she moves back to her hometown. She meets Jason Sudeikis. But what she discovers is at a certain time every day, if she crosses over this plot of childhood land that she was on, like a playground, this giant monster starts to rampage around Korea. And it's kind of acting like her.
Yeah.
And so once she discovers that, hilarity ensues, but then there's another plot twist to it, and it is
God bless Nacho Vigalondo. He's like the only guy who can tackle fucking batshit.
Yeah,
things.
And I've only seen the teaser trailer to this, but they don't give away too much other than that basic premise is that you can control a giant monster that rampages through.
Yeah,
and the teaser ends in a way that's like that's all I need to see. I can't wait to see.
And
this
I'm remiss
movie.
That I don't want to mention much more than that because that's the setup. And you know, I mean, like. Oh my God. I mean, like who, when I explain it to people and go a little bit more into detail, they're like, that sounds so weird, but so right. And I'm like, it is, it's deeply emotional. It's a great relationship story, but also a good finding yourself story, you know? And then the other two, we'll be going into further depth next week's episode when it comes to XX. But Killing Ground, I just want to mention, is a new Australian horror film from director Damien Power. Another one, kind of like another survival horror story about a couple who go camping in the back in the woods
in the outback,
and they encounter two locals, and then shit goes really awry. And
like Wolf Creek vein, realistic,
a little very hyper realistic, incredibly unsettling, especially if you have children. And this was the film that rattled a lot of people in the audience. But what Damien Power does to separate from the rest of the survival horror is misdirect you through his use of narrative structure. So things that we think are happening in the now aren't happening in the now. It's playing somewhere all the time. But really, really great film. And that one also got picked up. So Anyways, that's the Sunday It's Wrap-Up. So keep an eye out for 7852.
We'll talk about
XX. We'll talk about next week. Yeah, we have guests coming in next week.
From XX. Very exciting.
Yeah. So before we go into our interview segment, let me just say, guys, Severin Films has the newest release on the way. It's called Wild Beasts.
You bought it already.
Yeah, I bought it already. this one's from one of Italy's most controversial directors, Franco E. Prosperi of Mondo Cane. And let me just break it down for you guys, and you've probably already heard this already, but
we haven't heard you say.
We haven't heard me say, guys. Listen, when PCP gets into the water, wait for it, goes into a supply at the city zoo, the drug-crazed beasts, including tigers, hyenas, seeing-eye dogs, and sewer rats, not the sewer rats, go berserk and rampage through the streets of Rome. This is the greatest eco-revenge shocker in Eurocult history. The original poster screamed, "When nature revolts, you've never seen a film so bloody." Wild Beasts is now on Blu-ray and DVD for the first time, and it is packed with special features. Wild Beasts is available from all good e-tailers, and it comes with a free poster if you order it through Severin-Films.com. You got to make sure the dash is in there.
Yes.
For more info on Wild Beasts and other amazing movies, follow Severin Films on Facebook. I've already got my copy.
Bless them.
What
Bless
about
them
you?
For restoring movies like this.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's a thing.
And then they also have The Survivor coming out.
Yeah, ooh, I want to see that one.
Which sounds absolutely batshit
and
crazy.
And eventually Kathy's Curse.
And my favorite is released Santa Sangre. Buy that one here.
And you can also follow, I love following Severin on Instagram. They always post when they get their shipment in, but we think they're fantastic and you guys should support them.
Burial Ground merchandise, let me tell you.
They went all in on
Burial
Ground.
Peter Bark,
I love it.
Merchandise.
I love
Do me
it.
A favor, guys. You have to tweet at Severin whether it was Rob or Ryan's reading that convinced you to buy a copy. We are going to tally this up and reveal it on air.
But if you do buy it, and if you do tweet at Severin Films, tell them Shockwave sent you.
Yeah.
Tell them Shockwave.
All right. We'll be right back with our guests. All right. Now, I want to give a very special welcome to a filmmaker we have in the house tonight, Javier Gutierrez, who I reached out to via Twitter because I just wanted to say hello. And you and I got to chatting and I pitched you about coming on. It was very convenient that you're going to be in town for the week that we were recording this episode because Rings comes out this Friday and you're doing the press circuit for that. Yeah. So first off, thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. I know that doing a podcast in the smack dab in the middle of a press tour can be exhausting. So I appreciate
it. We are not going to ask the same questions that you got on the press circuit. So
I bet.
We're going to have a good time, right?
But my first question is, how are you feeling right now? You're like, at the time we're recording this and at the time that it airs, we're about 2 days out from the release. So how do you feel?
I feel exhausted. So I cannot really feel much because I was like, 3 days ago, I was in Madrid, then I was in Miami. I'm here. I don't even know what time is it now. But it's all good, all good.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
I know we'll get into the point in which you got into the Rings world. But I guess my first question is give us a little bit of a background because I remember your film that your first film got a lot of buzz and started kind of getting you on the Hollywood map. So let's take our listeners into the point when first you first did your first feature, your upbringing in Spain. You were telling us before we started recording that you were watching a lot of American horror, but were you kind of, did you have your thumb on the pulse of Spanish horror at all? Was there a lot of Spanish horror coming in?
There was not a lot of Spanish horror, but except for some director, this one called Chicho Ibáñez Serrador, that actually the other day I was in Spain because it's award season there, and they were doing a beautiful tribute to him, that he's still alive, he's older now. But he did like a very famous movies that we all grew up with in Spain. He used to run a TV show too, that he was playing like different movies. And one of the movies that really got me when I was a kid, it was called, the translation, the title would be Who Can Kill a Child.
Yeah. Also, the one we're talking about, The House That Screamed.
Oh, yeah, that's by
must
him
also
too.
Be the same director.
The House That Screamed, I just saw that one.
Chicho, yeah, he's a master. in horror. And so that's, I think we all in Spain grew up with him, all my generation. There was other horror movies, but it was not quite easy to check them out because it was not easy. We had two TV channels, but the horror was not like a, you know, something that was like very common in those times, like some time ago. And I grew up watching a lot of horror movies from Hollywood, right? And from independent. I actually was, and I'm still a fan of Wes Craven. Actually, Wes is the one that helped me to come here to the U.S. for the very first time.
Well, what were the elements of Wes's movies that were appealing to you?
Well, there is something about his early movies too, that kind of brutality that he has is like
dangerous.
It's really, it's visceral too, and combined with I think the early ones they were more like that. Then he become more like playful with the audience with black humor and things like that. But there is something in the first ones, like Hills Have Eyes,
House on the Left,
that somehow probably traumatized me when I was a kid, right? Hence the influence I have now. Especially when I work in Europe, like in movies like Before the Fall, that they go pretty violent, right?
Now, when you first discovered horror, did you fall in love with it right away, or did it scare? Because some people get scared, and it takes a few years for them to come back to it. Or were you a fan right off the bat?
I like it. I mean, it's not like I don't want to be just making horror movies probably my whole life.
Sure.
But I think it's you don't have to be ashamed of making horror movies. It's so good, you know. You can actually, for directors, if you check the filmography of a lot of directors like Roman Polanski, or a lot of the early movies, they are horror because you can play so much with the audience and you can enjoy the process and you feel like that connection with your audience when you're doing something, knowing that you're gonna get that reaction. You push them to the edge, and at the same time, if you work in supernatural, you have a lot of freedom to create a story or to come up with ideas out of the box, just because of the rules of the genre too and the intensity of it. So
it's a real director's medium of a genre, I think, compared to, say, a comedy where it's really up to the chemistry of the actors.
Totally. Yeah, you control it. You are the one who is pushing.
Yeah.
When you talk about control, I mean, like you're talking about the early, you know, early days of those filmmakers, you know, Polanski and Craven and even David Lynch and Cronenberg, you know, they're a lot more... Amazing. They had a lot more creative control, you know, until the studio system kind of got a hold of them and guided them down a couple paths. But yeah, their stuff, you know, they had their good heyday of brutality and, you know, and they had lost a lot of anger to get off their chest.
Times.
When did you, was there reading material? I mean, like we had Fangoria, we had Gorezone, we had stuff like that. Was that stuff ever imported? Did you ever get your hands on that stuff? Or did you have literature that you kind of gravitated to? Or was it just purely cinema?
No, it was purely cinema and some comic books too, like from old, you know, stores and things like that.
Yeah.
Scarecrow and things like that. Like there was a comic book that I got from my older brother. He was very weird. I have no idea where he found those comic books, but it was called the Hour of Horror or something like that. Yeah. And we're like comic books. They were not like superheroes. They were, I think it was like a British brand or something like that. And they were really, really fucked up.
Oh, wow.
black and white comic books. British like, I cannot tell you right now the names, but I still have them somewhere in my hometown.
Yeah, cool.
That's fantastic. And when did... So Before the Fall, you know, tell us a little bit about the origins of Before the Fall and kind of like how it started getting your, you know, your attention over here.
Yeah, well, everything began a long time ago with a couple of short films I did in Spain. One was called Brazil, and it's like a...
Well, I played at Sitges, right?
Yeah. It won the Sitges Film Festival. And that was like a black comedy, but it was like based on a revenge and black magic in the middle and everything. And after that one, I did a little piece that you can find in YouTube too, that is called Norman's Room. that is a tribute to Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho.
I'm going to look that up.
Yeah. It's our resident Psycho encyclopedic.
One of the best movies of all time.
Then you will enjoy this. It's just 1 minute short film.
All right.
And it's the crying in the shower from the point of view of Norman Bates' room.
Oh, wow. Hmm. That is cool.
It's very technical because I wanted to shoot it in 1 minute just using the elements of the old movies. So there's no editing, there's no nothing. It's just like one take.
Wow.
And 1 minute left. And we had like, it was like a challenge from the Spanish TV that they throw me like, okay, if you want to do something, I say, okay, I want to do something about Hitchcock. And was 1 minute and they give me 3 35 millimeters minutes to shoot. So I had 3 takes and it's pretty cool. So, well,
that sold. Cool. Can't wait to see it.
So, after that, I was working a movie, that I was putting together by myself and I was in Berlin. Well, this is a long story I'm not going to tell. It's a very funny story, actually. I was there because of a girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. Well, and there was the Berlin Film Festival. And I ran into one very big producer from Spain, Antonio Pérez. He's one of the, like, it's like the Harvey Weinstein of Spain, right? It's like crazy with a cigar. I ran into him in the restaurant of a movie theater in Berlin. I said, hey, you're Javier Gutierrez. I love your short films. We have to do something together. I have a new partner. I want to introduce you. So he introduced me his partner. He took me from that restaurant to a party in a club in Berlin, and it was Antonio Banderas. And I don't know exactly. I started in the restaurant, I end with Antonio Banderas. And 2 weeks later, basically, I was in Spain, back in Spain, working with them in a project, and what is Before the Fall. Mm. And was like super fast, like literally. That was like after the Berlin Festival, February. Like in June, we were in pre-production. In May, we were in pre-production, and I wrote the script with Juan. That is a friend of mine. He did like a rough version of a story for kids because he's a writer for kids. He had the original stories from him. Actually, I saw a script. They sent me a bunch of scripts. I was like, Javier, if you don't have time, we wanna do it now. And I saw this one that I think they sent me by accident because it was a story for kids about a fairy tale for kids, right? And I saw it and I say, okay, I like this one, but and they say, well, that's for kids. It's like it's kind of like a mistake, right? And I say, well, but there's something in the core of this that I can make for adults if you let me rewrite the whole thing and give me like 2-3 months. So I rewrote the whole script and become R-rated. And that's the beginning of Before the Fall that then was released in Berlin.
Right.
It's funny because it was like a loop, like a circle, full circle. I was like 1 year later exactly in the same theater, in the same restaurant. And I was releasing Before the Fall. And that's what brought me here to L.A.
That's insane. That's crazy. That's crazy. Now, who was the first producer or company that reached out to you once before, the American company that came reached out?
Wes Craven was the first one that when I had a screening here in the A5 Film Festival, and then I had another screening in the Screenfest, and we got all the awards that year for Screenfest, and one of the guys of Wes company came to the screening. Cody is now a good friend. You know Cody. He says, we love this. Wes would like to remake this and work with it, so we want to buy the rights. So from that point on, and I went there to work with them. The thing of the rights didn't work out because my producer in Spain, my friend producer, he's like Harvey Weinstein. He's like really rough to deal with. He didn't want to sell the rights. But during the process, I got to know Wes and Cody and all the family. And I started working a remake. I was going to remake for Wes People Under the Stairs.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it was like, it was like a very, very...
Another full circle element to your life because, you know, you grew up with Wes films and now you're working with them. What was your first impressions of Wes when you first met him?
I Well, he was pretty smart. Yeah. He was very smart. He had like a very good black sense of humor, yeah. Very mm-hmm. fast, very, and he was gonna be probably the best producer ever for me because he was very like sweet, like Javier, you care about your vision, and then we care later about the rating. Getting to know me, it was like probably it's gonna be a rated because it's pretty fucked up what you are talking to me about for people on this list, but right. You know, so it was pretty good. It was pretty good experience.
Well, that's interesting because you mentioned earlier that you loved his early films because they were kind of raw and dark, and then later he got this dark humor. I think People Under the Stairs is probably one of the strangest combinations of his dark humor.
Oh, like, yeah.
There's some. There's one scene with the what's his name? Is it Roach? In the when he hits him with the thing in the shaft, yeah. And Everett McGill's fall is one of the funniest things in Wes Craven's movies. So, I'm curious. I mean, I'm just curious. What would you have followed that tone, or would you have done something totally different if you had gotten to do it?
Mine was more like Freaks. Like the movie Freaks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
I was
cool.
Pushing it up very... I mean, if you let me do it, I go very dark.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was pretty dark. It was not, like, funny at all. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty cool, I thought.
And how far along did you guys get?
We went not too much because there was problems with the rights.
Yeah.
They were shared by Universal, and it was not going to work. So we started to talk about other projects with Jonathan's, his West song. Mm-hmm. And we started working another thing together. But I wanted to do that one pretty badly. Yeah.
And then from People Under the Stairs, what else? What did you move on to next?
Then I was toying with a couple of projects, and then I got to know James Wong.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like, I don't know, I'm in a loop of horror movies
somehow. Yeah, yeah.
And we got along very well. I was working with him, like, I say, okay, he told me, Javier, you want to do like a fast one, it's fun, and we do it, whatever. Say okay, and then we will start to talk about a movie that was called A House of Horrors.
Oh yeah,
that become demonic.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and we were working on that for a while, till a point that I was working with another one too with Bob Weinstein. Was called The Grace, and it was too many things on the table, and they were slow in some and the direction that the other project was taking, it was not like that fun for me. I wanted to go like R-rated. It was like too PG-13 for me and things like that. So I stepped aside and I keep going in another direction. But it was a pretty good experience.
Well, it sounds like a whirlwind experience to go from Before the Fall into getting into a collaborative process with Wes and then dealing with Bob and Harvey and dealing with Jay. You know, it's like... That's a lot of big people in the horror field, you know? So for you, where was your head at? I mean, were you just completely overwhelmed or, you know, were you kind of pinching yourself at the same time?
It was great. I think it was like a very cool, I didn't came thinking I'm doing horror, but somehow horror grabbed me, right? And I feel very comfortable because they were super talented people. Wes Craven was amazing. James Wan is amazing. Yeah. All the properties and all the projects I was working on, I really enjoyed the process. I mean, some of them, because of rights and problems, they were not going to ever happen, right? But like the one that came after The Crow, the following one.
I
was going to have to bring that up.
Yeah,
Kurt Crow is one of my favorites, but also today's Brandon Lee's birthday, or would have been his birthday.
Oh, wow.
Today?
Today, yeah. Oh, well, when this airs, 2 days ago.
The day we were recording this,
okay.
Yeah.
But it is today. But, you know, I mean, I think that's interesting to lead into The Crow. You know, you have this film, gets a lot of attention, all these people want to work with you. But how do you feel as a filmmaker that, you know, some people want to do an original project, but then they hit you with a remake. Is it a challenge? Because it's a great opportunity, but at the same time, I'm sure you have original stories you want to tell too. So how do you look at that as a filmmaker, tackling a property that already exists?
If it's something that the core idea, I get excited. Mm-hmm. Unless it's like The Shining, for example, I wouldn't do The Shining again, right? Because I think it's a masterpiece.
Right.
If I see something that I can take that I really like or I'm fond of it, for example, The Crow, I like the first movie, right? The Brandon Lee and Alex Proyas, I thought it was pretty cool, and for the time was great. But Ed Pressman, the producer, sent me the comic book.
Yeah.
I say, Javier, check it out, because I have a long story with it too, because we were talking a long time ago before the fall. I was talking about remaking Phantom of the Paradise. Mm. I don't know if you know that.
Wow. Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody knows that.
That's wild.
Yeah, that was wild. It was great.
We'll get into that after The Crow, because I'm really curious about that. Yeah.
That's one of the movies that traumatized me when I was a kid.
It traumatized you?
Yeah. Phantom of the Paradise, of course. I was like, what? It's a musical? It's a horror? What is it? And there's a tribute to the sober sequence of Psycho 2 there. You remember when?
Oh, yeah. It's a great one with the plunger in the face. It's great.
It was like fucked up.
Yeah. So you got the original Crow comic book, because I can't remember if this was when you were involved or not, because I'm a big fan. And look, they've made, what, 4 sequels, a TV series? They've done so much with it.
Yeah.
But I remember at one point the rationale behind remaking it was, we're going to go back and just try to redo James O'Barr's original story as much as possible. Was that the version you were working on? Because it is a really dark book.
That's why I like it. I saw the book and I saw that it had a different tone to the original movie that I knew. And then is when I said, like, okay, let's go for this, but let's bring on board James O'Barr.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have for another podcast to talk about how I went to Texas and phoned James O'Barr and brought him back to LA after 22 years.
Wow.
He's the coolest guy. He's very smart. He has a lot of really black humor, like very painful sometimes.
Yeah.
But it was pretty good. It was a pretty good experience. And to work with him and to at least to feel, I felt that somehow, because everybody was saying this movie, all the fans, like, it's fucked up, it's a bad karma and everything. Somehow the karma started to be better, right? Like just working with James on that and feel that everybody was finally on the same page, and we were going to try to do something serious, and we were going to do a rated 2, because at the beginning they were toying with a PG-13, but once James O'Barr and myself, we explained, like, look, this is the nature of this movie. It's about a rape, a revenge. I mean, I don't know, how can you do a PG-13 movie with that? Like, it's like... and they got it and they supported, and they were like, let's do it, you know, right? Let's do it right. Let's do a dark, rated, like. So it was pretty intense, pretty intense. 2 years. I was with them with 2 years and a half, 2 years. And we were all the time about to start. I literally talked with all the actors in Hollywood of that, like between 30 and 40.
Was this around the Bradley Cooper time?
Right after Bradley Cooper.
So was it Relativity still at the rights?
Yeah, that time was Relativity, yeah.
And that's why it's not being made. You don't have to say anything.
Yeah, Elric knows. He's got history.
Now, going back to Phantom of the Paradise quick, is Phantom of the Paradise Paramount? Is it a Paramount title?
Oh, man.
I'm just wondering if there
was
anything.
When I watched the documentary at De Palma recently.
No, I was just wondering if it was like a segue into Rings.
Well, either way, let's pretend it was.
Well, no, because I was, Phantom of the Paradise. So what was for you, I mean, like, give me, what would your Phantom of the Paradise be? Because, I mean, like, heart and soul remains today. I mean, like, especially in this industry, from being a sellout to being your shit, having your shit, ripped
so
off.
Crazy.
So you can take that. But as we just saw Rocky Horror Picture Show, turn into a live experience on television, and we're seeing Hairspray. Do you think Phantom of the Paradise is too obscure, or do you think that there is a place for it to redo?
I think there is. I mean, I like actually that it's very obscure, but I think there is a way to merge the total darkness with the pop part of it, right?
Yeah.
It just is a matter of, like, we were talking a long time ago about casting, like, the right, like, a singer. We were going to cast a good, very popular singer for the role of. I don't remember the name of the girl.
The Jessica Harper.
Jessica Harper.
Yeah. and Phoenix. It was great. It was very, very, wow. very cool. And I actually started to work on the script for at least in the treatment for the first 30 minutes or something. And yeah,
that's amazing. All right, so let's bring it up to the present. Rings, which comes out today.
My first question was,
oh yeah,
which one did you see first, the original Japanese Ring or the American Ring? What was your first experience?
Yeah, the first one actually was the American.
You saw the American version first.
Yeah,
okay.
I was in my hometown. I remember I watched it in a local theater very close to my house, and I freaked out. I went with my two sisters, and we were like, they were traumatized. They were like, "Oh, this is horrible! This is horrible!" It's like, no, it's okay. I mean, it's
how did
cool.
How do your sisters feel that you did the new one? the first one traumatized them.
Yeah, they are like, we knew we shouldn't take you to that movie. Well, that's pretty, yeah. And then after, because I like it so much, and I learned that it was an original movie by Hideo. I check it out, and then I say, okay, I see now where it comes from. All that disturbing atmosphere, all that, like, the translation of the Japanese culture to the American culture. Mm-hmm. I think Gore did a really, really brilliant job. Like, it's really hard to translate some, because there's no way to understand, and that's why it's so scary. That it's one of the points that brought me on board to the Ring, the fact that somehow I relate to that, not to the Japanese culture, but to that concept of the surrealism, because I grew up in Spain and I watched in TV Buñuel when I was a kid, and then in the museum in front of my house, it was copies of Dalí, all the surrealism painters, and that like uncomfortable feeling of being watching something that you quite not understand, but has some visceral pain there or an emotion that you can read there. So that's something that interests me
That's interesting. It kind of ties into a conversation we were having just before you came on. We were talking about the J-horror films and the remakes that held up and don't hold up. And The Ring, to me, is concept over culture. You know, it's such a high concept idea. You see something, you have 7 days, you die, it gets spread virally. Whereas The Grudge, I feel like, is tied, concept and culture are, you know, tied together so tightly. And I feel like that's why that one's a little bit harder.
Because the American one takes place in Japan.
Well, it takes place.
They don't update it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And it's hard to go, you know, say, okay, so it's a ghost and it's like fueled by a grudge because there's so much rage in the house, and like try to explain it to an American. And they're like, what? There's like rage in a house because there was something else. But I think that's why The Ring holds up so well. And that idea, its concept, so well done.
This is about the world we are living on right now. It's one of the reasons that when I heard like they were planning to do it, because Walter Park called me like, well, we have been working on a new one. I thought, oh, well, makes total sense, because it's a movie that spreads through, you know, a video, through images. And now we're in the 2015, 2016. Yeah. It's when actually you have more screens in your room than ever.
Yeah.
You have a TV, you have an iPad, you have a laptop.
In your pocket.
Yeah,
and everything's shared, you know.
Everything's shared.
Where they're sharing the videotape. Exactly, yeah. Instantaneously, yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't even watch the whole thing. You'd just watch the first few seconds and then share. Oh, you guys got to see this.
Well, Samara's like, would you just finish watching the video, please?
It's only 30 seconds. Just do it.
People lie. It will be like a pack of people dying the same week.
Yeah,
I'm just curious, when you came on board for Rings, because I feel that they've been trying to develop a third one for several years.
Yeah.
So I would imagine there's several versions out there.
Yeah.
Was there an idea set in place when you came on board, or is there room for you to kind of mold a basic idea? Or like, what was your starting point?
Walter wanted, Walter and Laurie, the producers, they were working for several years. Mm-hmm. They were trying to be responsible, and they wanted to somehow please the fans, keeping the core idea of Arwin's movie, all the mystery, all the investigation, but at the same time, acknowledging that we have a new generation of people that they haven't even heard of a VCR. They wanted to address that and put it through the point of view of a young cast and a new, totally new characters that they were going to push the movie in another direction and explore a little bit, not too crazy, but the new technologies. And to merge in this first chapter of the new Ruins world, both elements, the classic psychological thriller with horror elements of the original American Ring version, the Ring of Gore Verbinski, and what will happen if you remember in the first one, everything goes in the direction of Rachel Keller, because she shows up when one of the kids in college gets killed because of the urban legend. So we forget about the beginning of the kids, that actually is how it starts the first movie, and we go with Rachel Keller, the journalist. So in this one, we go back to the kids, what was going on, and we think, what happened if 15, 20 years later, that urban legend that was lost somehow is recovered and comes back to where it become and start like the urban legend, where it start to spread in the college, right? So we don't have a journalist, a character like Rachel Keller anymore, and we have like our new characters are the people who actually is playing with it, with the video, right? The young students.
Mm-hmm. Well, these movies, including the original franchise and the American ones, have gone in so many radical directions. I love them all. Like at the beginning of the show, I talked about Sadako versus Kayako because I love that they fought each other.
That's brilliant.
And Sadako 3D.
Do yourself a favor and catch up to it if you haven't seen it yet. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's really, really oddball.
Did you decide, when you took this project on, did you decide, all right, let me see everything that's out there? Or did you feel it was wiser to not revisit the original sequels or anything and just go fresh?
I try not to see things. I close myself in my bubble to protect myself from other influences, and because I don't want to suddenly feel, oh, this is great, I want to go in that direction, or I see Gore Verbinski and I love the original one and then I'm going to try to do the same thing. So, I mean, probably somehow, because I have seen all those movies, there is something that still is in my head, and unconsciously, it's going to be in my version of the movie, right?
Sure.
So, but knowing that, I'm not like crazy about exploring movies, or okay, I'm going to check all the Japanese movies now, or that's not my way of working. I'm very like anarchic, and I move with the flow and what I feel when I'm in front of my storyboard, when I'm drawing, doing my drawings and things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, what was the most technological challenge on this shoot? Because there's several. What's interesting about the Rings world is you can play and have fun with it. You know, in terms of how you set up Samara coming, you know, out of something, like whether it's a plane sequence or you know, from the TV when it gets knocked over, or whatever.
But flat screen TV.
Flat screen TV. So what was, you know, I mean, I'm sure that stuff was kind of fun, but what was the biggest challenge for you approaching this movie, and in particular, maybe some of the doing something new and exciting with some of the set pieces?
Well, for me, it was like the to find the middle ground between my radical ideas that sometimes I have, and what I have to respect from the franchise, and I have to preserve from what it is in the script, and to merge my personal world with the world that already exists of the franchise of The Ring, right? Mm-hmm. To find that balance, I think it's the, for any director that comes on board of a franchise, is the main thing. Mm-hmm. Like you may want to explore a direction, but there is certain limits that maybe you shouldn't go for them. And you, like, you know, there's too many elements to make, you know, the thing happens. So I think that's probably the thing. And when you go to a sequence, for example, the sequence of Samara crawling out from the TV, that's you take it like a particular, it was like one of the sequences that I pay special attention, because, I mean, I love the first movie, and that moment is like iconic. It was going to be impossible to do something like that, just because, at least because you don't have the surprise element anymore. You know that she's going to walk out from it. Everybody, since goes to see the movies, they sit down and they're like, okay, when is it going to happen? We want to see that. So to play with that and somehow make it feel fresh was one of the challenges that took time. And I think I work with the character of Sky, and if you see the movie, you see that he's not like the typical victim. She really fights. She really wants to win Samara, and she thinks he can win Samara. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, because beyond the conceptual hook, you also have to have a grounded emotional anchor, which is her.
Yeah.
You know, was it difficult or, you know, in terms of, I don't know which writer you dealt with, there's a lot of great writers on the script. You know, how did you try to differentiate it from the kind of Naomi Watts procedural angle from the first film? Here she's going through a kind of a similar journey, but for you, what was the appeal to her emotional anchor? What were you after?
Well, I think Naomi Watts was trying to save her life, right?
Yep.
And there was a plus because she was a journalist, and there was that curiosity that at the beginning she got hooked and tried to get till the end, right? In this case, it's more emotional because she becomes involved because she tries to save her partner, right? So trying to do the right thing, she gets involved in something really bad. And then she tries to fix it, and she thinks, because she's like young too, and she's like, okay, she's optimistic and she believes that things can be amazing and beautiful and beautiful endings. So she tries to actually go for it and think that fighting and finding the key elements that she's gonna put things right back like it was at the beginning of the movie. So it's more emotional. Yeah. That's basically the thing. She gets involved in the whole ring world because of Alex.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you had a chance to watch the film with an audience?
Yeah, well, not now, but right before I watched it with an audience, when we finished the movie, basically, we did like a test. I was pretty cool. I was like surprised with a lot of the reactions of the, like, there was a lot of people that they didn't see the
other
first
films,
two rings, and they didn't really need it, and they really, really liked the movie a lot. And there was a lot of people from the original ones that they embrace the new concept and they say, well, you know, it's quite different, but it's pretty cool. It's just a different, I mean, you have the same core. I think because I love the first one, I try to go back a little bit and at least visually as well, I try to take care of every shot so you can see the movie and see that, okay, the team behind this movie has been trying to somehow do a tribute to the first original movie. And visually, they have worked and tried to do something special in some sequences. So, it's like, and I think they appreciate it very much. And it was a nice surprise, actually, some of the reactions that I didn't expect in some of the audiences. Yeah.
I hope you get to see it with a Japanese crowd. That would be interesting to see you translating culture and remakes.
I totally want. How do the American Ring movies play
there,
in Japan? Because they do get released there, right? Like, isn't that weird? Like, I'm just curious.
Yeah, I have no
idea.
Be
interesting. That's a tough audience. It seems like that'd be a tough crowd. Yeah, yeah, so yeah, you go yeah, right yeah. to the heart
Turn
of it.
Over.
Did you have any scares that you crafted that you were sitting there going, oh, because you can never tell with certain scares until you see it with an audience if that payoff. But were there any that you crafted? You're like, okay, I can't wait to see if this is gonna get that reaction.
Yeah, there was things. I mean, I don't want to do spoilers.
Yeah,
but there was some sequences like there's one in the cemetery. In the cemetery that I was very curious to see because it's kind of it's a fast sequence, but at the same time it's kind of weird and. There's things where they shouldn't be, and it's like a kind of dreamy and.
Something like the surrealism you're talking about with
Powell, like you go there and suddenly the space becomes different, and so those elements I was curious to see. Okay, let's see how this translate, right? And how they write, and actually, that particular sequence got like really good.
Okay, I'll tweet at you once I see it. I'll be like, Bunuel will be proud or not.
I want to hear the best Vincent D'Onofrio story.
Love that guy.
This is where the publicist looks at us and starts rapping and
saying, we're getting a thumbs up. I want to hear the best. As you know, we worked with Vincent on Sinister, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he Skyped in, but it was, you know, he was there to do his thing.
Not Full Metal Jacket, you know.
Yeah,
it's a different. It's been a long time since then.
No, but I mean, he's a character, man. I would love it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the most...
he played one, he, for the audience out there, without spoilers, he plays a pretty pivotal part in the story, you know? So if you see him in the trailer, you'll be like, oh, wow, he's
he also, he's like that guy that as soon as he pops up, you're like, oh,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
him,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's hard with all the spoilers, but there's an action sequence that he's part of it. I thought it was like, what's the sequence for me?
That's awesome.
He did a pretty good job, I think. He nailed it, but it was pretty intense, that sequence.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious because, again, spoiler free, you know, this kind of maps out. It maps out. You could probably have some sequels, you know, to this film. Have you been involved in any talks or anything like that at all, or is it just kind of like a let's wait and see how this one does?
I think it's. I mean, I don't do plans ever. I don't plan, like I do the first rings, and I don't think about doing the second one. There is things that are exciting about if we do a second one. Because there is a lot of doors that we open and we never went to explore in this one because, you know, I think it's because we are doing like Apple does, right? That they put out the new iPad and then it's like, but you have it with a better screen already. Yeah, yeah, but you deliver in the next year, right?
Yeah.
So it's something like...
It's a question of things that Samara can fit through.
Yeah.
Can she fit through a flat screen TV? Yes. Can she fit through a small monitor? Absolutely. Can she fit through an Apple Watch?
We're going to develop...
Can she fit
the
through...
The Apple Watch, there you go.
Your Apple Watch, your iWatch. Can she do that? You're just a finger, like a pinky, just peeking through.
That's actually creepy. Really creepy.
Pinky pat.
She unplugs your headphones. That's all she can do. She her finger it. So it's like, oh, you bitch.
You had to obviously cast a new Samara. Who was the actress?
Well, it's Bonnie Morgan. That is the one that was in Ring 2.
Got it.
Yeah.
Oh, the actress. Is she the same actress from Mulholland Drive? And is she the woman who jumps out? And from Conjuring 2 as the nun?
No, it's Bonnie Ahrens.
Bonnie Ahrens, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All these physical, creepy characters.
Short ones, yeah.
All these Bonnies.
So what's next for you? What are you developing and working on?
I have a couple of things that I shouldn't talk yet
about it.
But I like to take my time between projects to see what's the next thing that feels right. And I'll just move always like following my crazy instincts and like, okay, let's go darker now or let's go lighter now.
In other words, Phantom of the Paradise. The remake has to happen.
I was going to say, like a romantic comedy.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what I'm gonna ask? One of the things I love about it's both the Ring franchise here in America and in Japan when they do new ones there is the marketing is spectacular.
Yeah.
So did you have any inkling about some of these prank videos that were going to be done? Or were they new to you too? Because the two that I posted on our website, one was at a TV store.
Yeah, TV store.
Which was great. The one I really loved was on Today, the morning show.
Oh, yeah.
It was set up as a TSA thing where they're like, let's look at these packages. And the host opens a suitcase and Samara comes out of it. Scares the shit out of her.
Nice.
But I mean, I could watch Samara pranks
that Samara
all day
fits
long.
In. Samara fits in a suitcase.
Exactly. So are you, as the director, are you privy to that or are you just as surprised?
No, actually, I mean, I because I love all those marketing campaigns from the Japanese movies, I was like, in social media, like when we were shooting the movie, I was posting all those crazy campaigns because
like
I thought they were...
Sadako throwing the first pitch.
That's great.
Yeah, in my Instagram and my Twitter.
Kayako had an Instagram account, which is amazing. Because it's like her the little kid. Like it's
crazy.
So
that's crazy.
Like, I love this. Yeah.
That's the best. I thought it was brilliant. I was laughing all the time. It's like, well, this is a horror movie, but I'm having a great time with marketing. Yeah, yeah. So I was like very excited when the marketing team told me, we are thinking to do a prank that is going to be really fun. I said, please, if you need anything, let me know because I'm totally supportive of those kind of marketing campaigns for for this movie.
Yeah.
And it was great. And now I think you can see a samurai everywhere in any TV channel,
yeah.
TV show, TV station.
Yeah, there's some good stuff out there.
She's just missing the Super Bowl.
You know? Like,
first
there.
Kick, you know?
Would have been fun.
That's awesome.
Comes through the big screen at the Super Bowl. Boom, halftime. Gets
her. Coming through the Jumbotron.
She's that big. She's Jumbo.
Parasamara. Come on.
Giving you all the good ideas
Jumbo
here.
Jumbo Samara.
Jeez. Things that she can fit through. Yeah, exactly.
Well, what about, you know, how much do you keep up on modern movies or modern filmmakers and horror in general? Do you watch a lot of stuff that's coming out now? Has there been anything that's excited you or surprised you?
Well, I like pretty much, I mean, I haven't, because I have been in my bubble till I finished the movie like almost in Christmas this year.
Yeah.
I haven't watched a lot of movies. I have a lot of them that I want to see. I haven't seen The Witch yet. I can't wait to see that one. I like from the year before, Babadook. I thought it was pretty cool. Yeah. And It Follows, and I think there's a lot of interesting ones now that I have to catch up.
Yeah, you have a year. If you're talking about It Follows and the Babadook, then you've got a
year. Like, it's a good year.
Yeah.
It's a good year. Yeah.
I think you'll love The Witch.
Yeah,
that's a great one.
I have to catch up now. I'm going to take like a month just to watch all the things I want.
You should listen to our Best of 2016 episode. Yeah. Yeah. Take notes.
Okay,
there you go.
Are you based still in Spain? Do you live there?
I'm in LA and in Spain. It's like back and forth, yeah. I mean, pretty much I've been living in LA for the last 3 years, not going to Spain only for holidays, but because of The Ring and because of The Crow too, I was like very, very much here.
Sure.
But whenever I have a little bit of time, I escape, I go back to Madrid and to Andalucía, to Córdoba, my hometown, just to so everybody remembers my face, right?
Very cool. Well, we appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good luck on Rings. I mean, it comes out today.
Today, it's out now.
Yeah, out now. So head to the theater and see Samara wreak havoc once again.
Yeah.
All right, Javier, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you next week, guys.